I'm very honored tonight to have my guest. A couple weeks ago, we had Veterans Day, Thanksgiving coming up next week, and so I've dedicated this month to veterans and from various conflicts, but veterans. And when we're talking about Thanksgiving and being thankful, I know that one thing a lot of us are thankful for is our troops and their sacrifice and service. And I wanted to honor that this month by inviting veterans on as my guest. And we've had a great lineup so far and going to be doing the same the rest of this month. But tonight, I have Bill Henry with me. Bill joined the Army immediately upon high school graduation. He did multiple tours in Vietnam and was treated for both obvious and then some not so obvious wounds. Bill is the past president of Vietnam Veterans of America in Omaha. He started a Memorial Day ceremony at Memorial Park, Omaha, now the largest in Nebraska, restored Korea-Vietnam Memorial in 1997 at Omaha Memorial Park, and has a permanent static display at the SAC Museum of articles left at the wall. Bill is a member of Heroes of the Heartland Foundation, Returning Veterans Resource Network, Nebraska Veterans Coalition, Nebraska Appreciation Rally. He is presently training to become a peer counselor for veterans with PTSD. Bill started in the Missing in America project in January of 2013. The purpose of the MIA project is to locate, identify, and inter the unclaimed cremated remains of American veterans through the joint efforts of private, state, and federal organizations. To provide honor and respect to those who have served this country by securing a final resting place for these forgotten heroes. Now, as I was saying to Bill earlier, I could have talked to the national organization, the Missing in America Project, but it was important to me when I found out that Bill and one other man started a branch of the Missing in America Project here in Nebraska a year ago. Because as I was thinking, and some of us have read, where two or more gather, hope. Hope is brought alive. And well, I'm going to let Bill tell his story, but part of the message here at Brain Injury Radio is that if you're out there and feeling isolated, wanting a way to help, the reason I wanted to have Bill on tonight is because here's two people that got together, are picking up the baton for the state I happen to come from. And I think he'll tell you that if they can do it, you can do it. And so I hope that their story will inspire people in other states who don't have a Missing in America Project branch to maybe get a hold of Bill and do something like he's done. So, Bill, are you with me?
Yes, I am.
Thank you so much for your service and for being here tonight. I really appreciate you taking your time to join us.
Thank you.
Great to have somebody on from Nebraska. You know, one thing I didn't say in the intro is that we do stream from 137 places to all 50 states and 36 countries. And one of the reasons, as I just said, that I wanted you to come on is I'm not only proud of you for your service, but proud of you for what you're doing for Nebraska right now with the Missing in America Project and all of the accomplishments that I just read that you're doing for our state. But also that you set a very good example for folks in other states out there to who've been wanting to help or feeling like there's something missing in their life to be able to help, and you can let them know just how that started for you. But I think what we'll do is start at the beginning. Excuse me, I got a little bit of a frog tonight. It's probably this single-digit weather that we've been having out there. But what was it, 11 below with the wind chill last night or something? But
if we
can just start at the beginning and tell a little bit about what was going on in your life and about you entering the war. Just give us a little bit of background.
First of all, I hope I live up to the billing that I've received. I'm not a licensed or practitioner or mental health or a doctor or anything like that. All I am is a person that joined the military in time of the Vietnam War. Reason for that was both my parents served in World War II, my father and my mother, all my uncles. Everyone in my family has served. Matter of fact, between my family and my present wife's family, we have over 130 years of military service since World War II, and someone in our family has served in every conflict. And I'm talking about Grenada and Somalia and everything that our elected leaders decide to send our nation's young men and women to do, and then drop the ball on them after they think, after they're tired of it. Do I think very much about our elected officials? No, I do not. But this is not a political show, so I'll just leave it at that.
well, it and, might be a little bit later, but you're right. Generally, we're not. But I do like people to know, and we'll go back. I'm going to let you finish what you were saying, and we'll talk about that a little bit later, because we talked. Well, of course, now with my brain injury, I don't remember if it was you or the man next week, but we were talking about the healthcare system and what resources are not available to our veterans. And I pointed out to who I was talking to that, you know, we had government-sponsored healthcare before. You know, we've had the VA, we've had Medicare, we've had Medicaid. Those things haven't worked out so well, but desperate people do desperate things out of ignorance, and now we all have government-sponsored health care, and it doesn't seem to be working out very well when it comes to some treatments that should be made available, as far as I'm concerned. So, yeah, we're not going to make any political statements, but sometimes they come up. So that's granted. I think we have freedom of speech here on this show, too. So, okay, we'll go back. Wow, what a pedigree in your family of service to this country.
Well, from, you know, from an early age, I was raised to respect the military, and I live here in Omaha, and we're next to Offutt Air Force Base, and my parents used to take in airmen that did not want to live on base, and so furnish them with a room, and they could eat with us and everything like that. I've never wanted anything in my life other than to be a soldier. So I volunteered for Vietnam, and like I said, I spent multiple tours. I extended one tour, then I even re-enlisted to stay for a third tour, and then that a little guy with the straw hat and the tire sandals decided that I had enough. So I was able to come home and try to put my life together. But I'm like every other male that lived and was raised in the 50s and 60s with John Wayne and, you know, all of our superstars, and from my father too, men don't cry. So, you know,
sure.
I did the same thing as everyone else did. I came home by myself. I had problems. I was forced to take off my uniform when I landed in California. The military wanted me not to wear a uniform, but I still stood out with my short haircut, and my the only pair of shoes I had were military low quarters, so, you know, I might as well have had a neon sign on my back that that, hey, everybody that wants to beat on a soldier, here I am. But yes, I came home, and even when I got here, you know, my parents were proud, all my relation was proud, my friends were proud, and this was 1968 when, you know, the protest and everything really started, and my parents had been life members of one of the veterans groups, National Veterans Groups, I won't mention their name, so they took me down to the post, and I was in my uniform. And believe it or not, that veterans organization refused to serve me because I was a Vietnam vet. So,
you're,
you know,
kidding.
Yeah, that kind of sets the stage for, you know, because in Vietnam, you know, they didn't, you know, we never heard the everything that happened here in the States, all the protests and everything. You know, they censored everything that we heard and everything like that. So, you know, it's knew some of it, but, you know, when you walk in the door and, wow, you know, people, you know, I had employers that refused to, you know, they took my application and basically just threw it in file 13 right in front of me. So, you know, it's it was one of the things, and that doesn't help your mental attitude that you might have. And I worked in almost every bar in town as a doorman, and I had a very bad attitude. I really did. So, but, you know, it's, and, you know, finally got a real job, and I got married, and my first wife, I have to give her credit. She put up with a heck of a lot of stuff, and, but in the end, it did not work out, so... that's about it. I started working and paying Social Security when I was 12 years old. So that gives you, and I lived above a bar, so that gives you an idea of where I grew up at. And but I still had this strong, you know, of the military, and with my present wife was in the military also. And so I tell everybody that almost all my total life I've lived under a first sergeant, because my mom was you know, very we was very orientated on what we did, how we did it, and everything like that. So
wow.
I think it, you know, it did a lot for me. You know, I had to, if I wanted any extra money, I had to work for it. So that's fine, you know. I worked all through high school. You know, I wasn't a football player or an athlete or anything. I was just a normal guy that liked cars, but I had to work, and that was it. And upon graduation from high school, I went down to the recruiter, and I said, I want to join. And he asked me what I wanted to do, and I said, well, I'd like to be in a helicopter if I could. And he kind of looked at me, and he gave me, you know, all this spiel and everything. Well, I ended up in the infantry, so that's how smart I was. I got to ride in a lot of helicopters, but I got to be a door gunner for a while. But I didn't fulfill my dream of being a helicopter pilot.
I want to stop you for a minute. This was a time that so many people were getting drafted, and you actually went and enlisted. So I think that's a double ripoff that you didn't get to be in the helicopters, for God's sake. You went of your own volition and signed up.
Yeah, I could have probably waited and, you know, waited for the draft or whatever, but I figured, like I said, I never wanted anything but be a soldier in my total life, all of my parents, friends, my aunts, my uncles, you know, especially my uncles and all my friends' parents, you know, they were in World War II or Korea or, you know, on and on. So it was just the way it was. And when I went to Vietnam, it was popular. Okay, it's just like, you know, when we sent our young men and women over to the sandbox, which is Iraq, Afghanistan, this last time, and you know, it was somewhat popular. And so, you know, I've learned one thing about the American public and our politicians: if it can't get done right away, they lose patience. They want to change. That's how it is. You look at it now. These young men and women, I have a nephew that's in Iraq now, and I have another nephew that is in Afghanistan. And between our families, we have served 12 tours of duty in the sandbox. So
Goodness.
It's in our family.
I guess.
And it, you know, it's the way it is. And you know, I went to work from three great boys, and you know, I worked and everything. Lost a few jobs because of my bad attitude, but there was nothing wrong with me. You know, it was all the world that was wrong. I just figured, you know, that's the way I am, and that's the way it is, and so I'll do the best I can, and moved to California, lived there a while, came back, and, you know, changed jobs, and the normal mental health problems that nobody sees. You have to remember that before Vietnam, you know, before we started demonstrating and trying to get our government to do something with Agent Orange and the VA and everything, World War II soldiers, Korea, ever since the beginning of the Revolutionary War, the soldiers were expected to come home, go to work, and act like nothing happened. Shell shock, you know, battle fatigue, they had words for it, but they really had no help. And because of the Vietnam veterans, we have made an industry out of the mental health medicine. If you check all of your books and everything like that, you will find that after the 70s, you know, after Vietnam was over and people started realizing, oh, man, there's something wrong. We got to do something to help these guys. But not all the guys, myself included, thought that they needed help. You know,
right
here in Omaha in 2012, the VA figured that we had, and this was in February, you know, one of the coldest months of the year, that there was 400 homeless veterans in the city of Omaha. Now, you're talking a metropolitan area that's got 400,000, and you got 400 veterans, according to the VA hospital, that are homeless. And so, you know, there's a problem there. And I didn't realize it until in the 90s, I met some Vietnam vets that were really, it was somebody I could talk to, somebody that could understand me, somebody that, you know, wanted to hear, somebody that was able to ask me questions without accusing me. You know, they didn't come right out and say, well, what happened to you? What did you do? Blah, blah, blah. You know, all the all the typical things that a non-veteran will ask somebody. And, you know, and I met these guys, and they had been doing different, it was with Vietnam Veterans of America, and next thing I know, I become their president and everything, but they helped me immensely. And then I finally started to realize that I need help. There is something mm-hmm. there. There's something that's not right. I need mm-hmm. help. You know, the nightmares, couldn't sleep and everything. And I still go to the same psychiatrist that I started in 1995. And I still take medication for sleep and for, you know, for different mental health illnesses. I tried the VA, and, you know, they're the best pill pushers there are. They yeah. just want to give you a pill, and if you don't think it's right, you go see another doctor, and he wants to give you some other pills because the first doctor didn't know what the hell he was doing, and he, you know, keeps going. And next thing you know, you have a whole counter full of different pills, and you start looking at it going, whoa, you know, I can't take all this because I'd walk around in a daze. You know,
right.
And then you get, you know, you get in the, you know, you go to work and you don't produce, and then you come home and your every little thing sets you off, and you start fighting with your neighbors, you start fighting with your friends, you lose all your friends that were not veterans and they didn't really understand, or they didn't like the Vietnam War, you know, they were out protesting or whatever. So it's it was really, you know, I was out for 15 years, over 15 years. And before I knew that there was something wrong, but I didn't want to go, I didn't want to admit it. I felt like less of a man because of that. You know, I was raised that men don't cry, you know. No matter if whatever you do it the best you can. You do it better than everybody else. And if you get hurt, you just shake it off and you keep going. And that's how it is in the military, too. A lot
right.
of these guys that have problems, you know, they, if they're afraid to go to their commander and say, you know, I got my bell rung, you know, and I'm having these headaches, or I can't sleep, I'm having nightmares, because if they want to stay in the military, you know, that's a red flag, and they're going to lose it. They're, you know, first chance they get, they're going to get rid of you. They might transfer you to a different unit, but they do it. And, you know, I work with a lot of these veterans through these different organizations, and I see it, and I talk to them. And, you know, I also write Patriot Guard. Why do I write Patriot Guard? Because I want to make sure that these kids, no matter whether they, you know, were KIA or they just came home and they're wounded, that they do not go through the mental anguish that I did. And I think every vet, if you look at the Patriot Guard writers, and the American Legion writers, and you know, these different organizations that do funeral escorts and, you know, welcome home and everything like that, they are mostly made up of Vietnam veterans, because we know what it's like to come home to an ungrateful nation.
Yes, and I think that, you know, you mentioned shell shock. That was well known vernacular back in World War II, and during this war, PTSD and TBI are being talked about so much. But, you know, I don't think that there's a war that's happened, because it's just kind of a, and not at all any commentary on your family's service. Service to your country is great, but I don't think a state of war is a natural thing for the human mind to process. You know what I mean? And so
yes, I do.
To have, and, you know, PTSD, it didn't just start with this war that's going on now. our Vietnam veterans, you know, whether it's shell shock, PTSD, whatever you want to call it, there's some emotional ramifications for being in that, subjected to that kind of environment. And then, as you say, coming back here, it's got to look completely different here than it did before you left, and trying to reintegrate and not talk about the depth of the things that you saw that are so unnatural to those who've never walked in those boots, has got to be extremely difficult. So that was another reason I wanted you to come on and talk, is we have a lot of veterans from this war talking about TBI and PTSD, but this isn't where it started.
Well, the suicide rate in the United States for the United States Army right now is 22 a week. Now,
yes,
figure that out. That's 22 kids, and I call them kids because, you know, I'm way over the hill, that take their own lives. I have, in the month of October, I went to 4 funerals where they were on active duty. They were here in the States, that they committed suicide. And one of them was a friend of mine's son. And
oh, no.
So it's, you know, and, you know, you don't even have to really be in combat to get, you know, PTSD. Everybody's mind is different. Everybody's affected by something different. They've seen or heard something or had something happen to them that sticks with them, sticks in their mind. And my most vivid and worst thing in my mind is something that happened to me before I even went into the military. I was working part-time at one of the slaughterhouses, in one of the packing houses. And
sure.
I worked on the kill floor, and me and my best friend, we worked on there. And his job was, as you force the cattle through, and this was in the early 60s, as you force the cattle through, they go through the final chute singly, you know, but they're scared. They smell the blood. They hear all the, and everything like that. And his job was to straddle that and make sure that the cattle went through. Well, he used a .22 rifle that shot a slug, and that was to kill the cattle. And then as they would fall, somebody, you know, me or somebody on the floor would hook them up by their hind legs and put them, you know, raise them up, and they would go along. Well, this one day, and he knew better. He'd been working there, you know, off of summers and weekends, just like I did for a couple of years. And there was, you know, they was really bunched up there, and he took that .22 and he used the butt of it to hit this cow in the back of the head. Well, unfortunately, it discharged and it blew his head off. Now,
your friend?
Yes, 17 years old. And
oh my
God, sticks into my mind more than what happened to me in the military.
You were so young,
so
unexpected.
And, you know, when I was in the military, I joined when I was 18. Okay, you know, I just turned 18, and you know, mom signed up. You know, fine, have fun. Go, you know, be careful and everything like that. And so, but that is one of the worst memories that I have at night. Is that? So it isn't always just the military, or it isn't always being in combat or whatever. Something happens everywhere. And, you know, like you have a brain injury, and something happens somewhere. And, you know, when we were born, nobody, you know, our parents didn't figure that they would, you know, something would be wrong with you. You know that, you know. And so it's a lot of different things. You know, you can blame it all on, you know, for the veterans. You can blame it on, you know, fighting a war, and yes, that has a lot to do with it. But you know, there's truck drivers that have it. There, you know, you just, there's something that bothers everyone, and it might not bother me. And I'm sure you have some listeners thinking, oh yeah, well, you know, so he was only a friend, you know, whatever, you know. He's 17, he should outgrow it and all this and that. Well, you never outgrow it. At least I didn't.
Oh, no. Well, no, that's, you know, being that young, you're at a very vulnerable age. And even though you don't, you know, in a war theater, you might reasonably expect that something like that is going to happen, but not at work. And at such a young age, of course, it's going to make a lasting impression. And, you know, my uncle was drafted into the Vietnam War at 18. And, you know, I was 8 at the time. I always remember his age because there's 10 years difference between us. So when I was 8, he was 18. And, you know, and he seemed like he was older. But, boy, you know, in retrospect, when I was 18, I was a, you know, 18-year-olds are kids, you know. There's a lot of developing left to do. You know, their brains aren't even fully developed at that time. And so, of course, that's going to make an impact on you. I'm sure that going to war after that was difficult, but it doesn't surprise me that you'd have the PTSD from a personal experience before you were even at war. And I know what you're saying. A lot of people here, I have that diagnosis too. One reason I won't talk about, I'm not the guest tonight, but a second reason is that, you know, when your brain blows up, you know, you're 35, healthy, at the top of your game, and your brain blows up and they crack your head open like an egg, that's a very traumatic experience to have, and it changes your life forever. And those are some things to have nightmares about too. And so your point is well taken, that post-traumatic stress disorder, or whatever name we call it, comes from a lot of different sources. We're hearing a lot about it with veterans in the war, but people have these experiences from being abused when they're a child, witnessing a violent crime or something like what you witnessed. A lot of different reasons that impact people emotionally with lasting scars. Point taken.
When I was in Vietnam, I was a LERP. That's same as a scout sniper now. We had a team of 7, and all 7 of us, you know, we made it out. But I am the only one left alive. 3 of them died in alcohol-related auto accidents, and the other 3 died of Agent Orange. Luckily, you know, I'm still here, and I knock on wood every day of my life, thinking, wow, you know, it's it can happen to anyone at any time, and, you know, you see it all the time. So you just, you know, you have to take one day, and I hate that cliche of taking one day at a time, but it's true. You know,
It is true.
You know, you got to try to not worry about, at least myself. You know, I'm talking about myself. I'm not trying to influence any of your listeners or you or anybody else in the world. I'm talking about myself. I have to try to look forward to what I'm going to do tomorrow and try to forget what happened yesterday. And I have found that helps me survive. And then, you know, like I said, I'm basically a military brat. And so that's why I do so many things for our veterans, because even my psychiatrist says, when I told him about this Missing in America project and everything, he says, you know, that's the best thing that you can do, because, you know, you can build a memorial and you can have a display, or you can have a set up a ceremony and everything, and it's basically forgotten, just like that. But when you find somebody's family that they didn't know where their brother, sister, father, mother, or whoever, they didn't know where they were at, okay? You don't know the circumstances, but if you're able to find that family and reunite them, even though the veteran is deceased, they are getting closure. And that is everlasting to somebody. And to me, that
Absolutely.
is more fulfilling than all that other stuff that I've done as being a veteran, trying
Now,
to help out veterans.
let's back up for just a minute and
Yeah.
tell us about what the missing, for those people in the audience who don't know, tell us what that program is. I get that by you serving others, you're able to get out of yourself. By working a day at a time, we're taking it in bite-sized pieces and not getting swallowed by the past and the future. I get all that, and I talk a lot about that, those principles of recovery, I'll call them, here on the show. But tell the folks out there about the Missing in America project, how you happened upon it, how you happened to hear about it, and then tell us what it is.
Well,
What
the
it is.
Missing in America Project is, we are probably the smallest veterans organization in America. I think we probably have a total of 500 volunteers. We're in all 48 of the lower United States, and we are 100% volunteer. By that, I mean that the money that we raise, we don't get any payment. I am not reimbursed for my expenses for anything. So like when you heard about me, I did a presentation for the Daughters of the American Revolution here in Omaha. And I do fundraisers. I do a lot of fundraisers, and that's how we get our money. Larry Shaver and myself, we are the only two. We cover all of Nebraska, and when we bury somebody, we have to bury them in a state or federal or VA cemetery. Well, Nebraska's closest VA cemetery is 288 miles away. It's not like somebody dies here in Omaha and you take them, 5 blocks, 5 miles, or whatever. We escort that veteran to his final resting place at Fort McPherson at Maxwell, Nebraska. But Missing in
Wow.
America Project, we are 100% volunteer, like I said, and our first year, Larry and me probably spent out of our own pocket $10,000 to $12,000, because we were not prepared. For we were told that you're going to have to visit all the funeral homes, all the crematoriums, all the mortuaries and everything, and convince the directors that you are there not to point fingers or not to place blame, but to find that veteran and hopefully and try to find their next of kin and reunite them. And if you cannot find them, find the next of kin, you will give that veteran a military honors funeral at no charge to the funeral home or to the family if you do find them. So, we started this, and we started sending letters and everything, and we was told that, oh, don't worry about money, because you won't even get into a funeral home, or nobody, you'll be knocking on doors, you'll get rejected and everything. It'll be 6 months to a year before you even get your first name. Well, we started on January 27th. On May the 10th, we had 10 names. And I'm going, holy
Wow.
crap. How am I going to, pay for all this? So I started fundraising right away, but we still spent all this money, because the only thing we got from National was just a packet of instructions on ideas on how to do it, what to do, and the laws, because we have to follow all state and federal laws to the letter. We can't deviate at all, come up with some little idea or anything like that. So it's and the way I heard about Missing in America Project, it was probably back in 2006, 2007, there was an article in World News Tonight and in the Omaha World Herald about a funeral home where it had went out of business, and they had found thousands of cremated remains in this closet or in this storage area that were in plastic bags, boxes, tin cans, and everything like that. That
my
were unclaimed,
God.
And they all, the paperwork of the funeral home wasn't that, So, they had on there, would you like to send a donation and everything? So, my wife and me both being veterans and thinking a lot of the military. My wife has seven siblings, and every one of her brothers and sisters served in the military also.
Jeez.
So, that gives you an idea how I'm related to a first sergeant my whole life. But so we sent them a donation, and, you never think anything else about it. Well, my in-laws, they work for the federal government, most of them, and they all live in Virginia and Maryland and everything. And I go back, I ride Rolling Thunder, and, I ride a motorcycle. I'm a biker. And, I am. So is my lawyer, and so is my psychiatrist. So I guess we're not all really tough drunks. But so
nice
I
to
went
know.
Back. I went back to Arlington because I try to go back to the wall at least three times a year. I was there for the dedication in '82, and I keep going back. Well, Arlington has this thing called Wreaths Across America. It's a company in Maine a guy started, and this was in 2012, December 2012, and they needed volunteers to help put wreaths on graves. Well, they had 40,000 wreaths to put out. So, I told my wife, she says, I'll go. All it's going to cost you is your gas and everything, and because you can stay at mom's, you can stay at my brother's, you can stay at, so that's all you got to worry about. Okay. So, that's how she twisted my arm, really hard. And so I went back, and, the people that were there and the wreaths, putting them out, and they do go to every state, in the country, but they're not that well known, like in Omaha, I think they get something like 500 wreaths to put out, at the various cemeteries where they know there are veterans there.
Right.
So anyway, I went there, and my two oldest sons live in Phoenix, and I hadn't seen them in a while. So, I told my wife, I says, we're having and right afterwards in January, not only in February, you got Barrett Jackson, which I am a car nut. One of my friends, his son, was being deployed, and he lived in Phoenix. So, I went right to Phoenix. I'm down in Phoenix, and I'm riding in this escort for these guys. And these people that – and I thought that I was going to be, the odd person, the only person from Omaha. Well, there was only four people out of 35 – that were from Arizona, and there was something like 15 people from Omaha, Lincoln, and Council Bluffs. So,
gosh!
Yeah, all the cotton heads, what my son calls them. They go out there for the winter. So, they're talking about MIAP, and I listen to it, and I, what's this? And they're kind of trying to explain it to me and everything. And I said, man, that sounds kind of interesting. So, after I'm done, I head to Omaha, and I walk in the door and, talk to my wife. And she says, oh, by the way, I just got an email. And I said, well, who's it from? She says, I don't know why I got it, but it's from a organization called MIAP, and they wanted to know if I still wanted to volunteer to do something. And I said, what's MIAP? And, you know, we're talking about it. And I said, well, I talked to some guys in Arizona, and they was telling me about it, and it seems like pretty nice. She says, well, why don't you call them? So I called the guy. I tried to call them their state rep, and they didn't, that they had listed, and, you know, no answer. So I finally called national, and they said, well, we need somebody. We have one gentleman there, but he's by himself, and, you know, he works, and he can't do it all. Would you be interested? And I said, oh, okay. And, you know, I talked to him, and they gave me Larry's name, and I called him, and we set up, you know, we set an appointment to meet together over a cup of coffee. And I sat down with this guy, and he's a Marine. I mean, can you imagine an Army and a Marine working together, you know, as friends? But he's a Marine, and we started talking. Yeah, we think we could do this. I mean, we hit it off. You know, you would have thought that we had known each other forever. You know, there's times in your life when you meet somebody and you automatically connect, and that's what we did. So I told my wife about it. She remembers things a heck of a lot better than I do. And she said, didn't we send a donation to this company about, you know, about cremation? And I said, no, I don't think so. And she said, yeah, I think I did. So she gets out the old checkbook and she starts showing me. Yeah, see, we sent them some money. I said, oh, okay, that must be how you got it. But why did they send it to you instead of me? I don't know. And she said, well, probably because I'm the boss of the house. I said, yes, Sergeant. So that's how I got started in MIAP. You know, by accident and by luck. And it's the most fulfilling thing I've ever done, really, for myself and in my life. Now, so, you know, we had our first burial in September, on September 6th of 2013.
Now, tell us how it works and kind of what their mission statement is.
Well, what the mission statement is that we... Like I said, we're a national organization, and, you know, we CFC and everything. But our mission is to locate, identify, and inter the unclaimed cremated remains of veterans through the joint efforts of private, state, and federal organizations to provide honor and respect to those who served this country by securing a final resting place for those heroes. And, yes, I did read that. So this is a public service announcement.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
And if these forgotten veterans have no family to invite us, do we leave them sitting in a storage closet? No. We try to find them. And if we cannot find them, we show our sincere respect to them. And we work to ensure that they receive a dignified final resting place to honor the veteran of this country that signed that line one time in their life. I don't care if you were drafted or you volunteered, but when you signed that line, you basically gave the United States of America a blank check to do with your body, okay? And a military funeral is to honor them for their service. That is the only thing so far that our government has not taken away from a veteran. You know, they always said, you know, you serve 20 years and you'll have it made for the rest of your life. Well, they cut the retirement. Well, you'll receive health care the rest of your life. Well, they cut that. You know, and it's just... And people ask me, well, why do you not think too much about politicians? Well, guess what? You used me, and now when you're done using me, you throw me away. And that's how I look at it. And I'm sure that a lot of these veterans that are listening, they know exactly what I'm talking about. MIAP started in 2006. Our director, Fred Santelli, he was in Idaho, and he went to a friend's. He was a Vietnam veteran, a major in the Army, and he went to a funeral of a friend of his. And while he was at the cemetery, he was talking to the, you know, the director of the cemetery, and they was in the funeral home, and they was talking about their unclaimed veterans that they had. And he said, "What? You know, this is the United States. That does not happen." And they said,
"You ought to believe."
Yeah, mm-hmm. That's what everybody thinks. You're out of your mind. You're crazy. But so he went later. He went to the funeral home, and they had 27 veterans cremains sitting on shelves, unclaimed. And then they had other ones that, you know, were not veterans. Well, because of our national charter, we can't do anything for them. Unfortunately, I wish I could, but I can't. And so he started working on it. He came up with this program where we use all the information that the funeral home might have, and we try to locate the next of kin. Sometimes you find them. Sometimes you don't. You know, a lot of the next of kin don't want to have anything to do with them. You know, they fell out of favor with the family. And I think everybody that has a, you know, everybody that's listening knows how that is. You know, if you argue with your neighbor or somebody you work with, okay, you know, you get over it. But when you argue with a family member, your brother, your sister, your mother, your father, and you say something or they say something that really hurts, it's always there. It is always there. So what happens? You fall out of favor with them. Maybe you move. Maybe you have PTSD, or you don't want to be part of society. You can't stand the rat race and everything. You would rather be homeless. There are a lot of them. Or you could have been where you outlived your children. You outlived, you know, everybody in your family. Hazel Wood, that I buried last May 30th, she outlived her whole family. You know, we're not supposed to bury our children. That is not supposed to happen. That's not how, you know, we was programmed when we first were born and as we were raised. You know, when mom and dad pass, we bury them and everything, and we go on with our life. We have our kids, and they bury us, and it's a progressive. Well, it don't happen that way. Believe me, it does not happen that way. So we try to find the next of kin. And by doing this, you know, first we try sending letters to all of the list of names and everything that the funeral home or the mortuary might have. We'll send them a certified letter, and if they cannot find it, you know, if we get no reply after 30 days, I have 13 genealogists here in Omaha that volunteer to help me. And I turn the name over to these genealogists, and they do their magic. You know, you being part of the DAR, I know what I'm talking about.
Yes, yes.
What a genealogist does. And so they try to do their magic. Now, if they come up with, you know, a cousin or anything that might be related, we have to send them a registered letter and say, you know, are you related to, I'll use my name, Bill Henry. And so if you know him or you're related to him, please contact funeral home such and such. You know, they don't contact us. They are supposed to contact the funeral home first. Well, a lot of times they'll contact us and they'll say, well, I got this letter and I just, I want to, you know what's about it, what happened to him, what's he doing in Omaha, Nebraska? I never even heard of Omaha, Nebraska. You know, is that a cow town where they still have cattle running up and down Main Street? You know,
mm-hmm.
You being from Nebraska have heard that, I know. But
you bet.
So they kind of, you know, they're asking us all these questions. And so I try to answer them as well as I can. And I ask them, what do you want to do with the remains? Well, some of them say, I don't want to have anything to do with that person. I don't care. You do with whatever you want. I've had them say, well, I'll pay for it. Well, that's nice of you to offer to pay, but we do not charge anything. We pay for everything. We pay for the urns. We pay for all of the legal fees. We pay for everything.
Wow.
Oh, really? Can you at least send me the flag and some pictures? Oh, yeah, no problem. So give me your address and everything and sign a release. And I send them a release, and they sign it, and I take care of it. Now, if you don't like rejection, you don't want my job, because the funeral homes are very leery. You know, they think that we're out to point fingers, blame them. You know, why do you have this guy on the shelf? Why do you have this? Why do you do that? You know, so they're worried about the bad publicity. You know, like here in Omaha, there's almost 40 funeral homes in this city. You know,
yeah.
We're only 400,000 people. You know, it's very competitive. So they can't afford any bad press. So they're afraid of that. And they're afraid of getting sued, because you know as well as I do that somebody that gets upset or mad or whatever, or they can even think that they might be able to get some money, will find an ambulance chaser, I mean an attorney, they're out there, that will take on anything, and they'll just hope for a settlement or whatever. So they're worried about that. And then there are some, like the Good Shepherd Funeral Home here in Omaha, that care about the veterans, that want them to have, and they'll say, you know, here, you do it. But what I do, I have to sign a confidentiality agreement with these funeral homes. And by that, I mean that I will not divulge to anyone where this veteran's remains came from. As far as everyone knows in this, in Omaha and in the area, all of the remains that I have buried or that I have found the next of kin all came from Good Shepherd Funeral Home, because they want to help the veterans. They bend over backwards to help us. They got us discounts for the urns. The urns, there's a picture of one on your link.
Program page.
Of one of the urns. They're very pretty. They're
yes,
really
they are.
Special, and they're really nice, and they're not cheap. I'll just say they are not cheap. So it's, you know, so I have a funeral home that wants to do this. And so I set up the ride. I set up the service. I scheduled the military, the honor guard, color guard. I scheduled the speakers, the everything out at Fort McPherson, which is, again, I say 288 miles. And I put it out on our social media, on Facebook and on the web. And by word of mouth, because especially with the motorcycles, because so many of them are veterans, or you know they care about it, or they just like to ride the motorcycle. And we will have a procession that goes for 288 miles. Now,
good
we
Lord,
also,
there's
we
not
stop.
One. That thing it off it. I was just curious. What is the isn't that a veterans cemetery?
They have a veterans cemetery that has been closed since 1973. And there in Omaha, we are scheduled to have a new one built. It will be the Omaha National Cemetery outside of Omaha, about 5 miles, that is scheduled to be ready to receive remains in 2016. But in the meantime, I take everyone out to Fort McPherson. Now, state of Nebraska, they have a veteran cemetery, but that's in Alliance, and that's 410 miles away. So, you know,
right.
I'd rather go to. But we put this whole ride together.
Wow.
Now we stop in every large town along I-80 for people to either join or just to pay their respects to the veterans. We'll have the National Guard. They'll come and, you know, offer a hand salute and a brief ceremony. People might not go all the way because they have to work or whatever. So they get off, but we get people joining us. Like in September, we started out with, 26 motorcycles right from the very start. And when we got there, we had 151. And then that doesn't count the people from western Nebraska that came down.
Wow.
And then after the ceremony, I line up a meal for everyone through the VFW or a different organization or a company, and we offer a meal to these people because, you know, they've rode this motorcycle because we start at 5 o'clock in the morning. And our ceremony isn't until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. It lasts until 4 o'clock. And then by the time, you know, it's been a long day to be riding that motorcycle.
No kidding.
So we put all this together. And right now, since we started counting, we have had two services. We buried 3 in September. We buried 5 on May the 30th. Now, we did one thing that was very unique on our May the 30th. We had two ceremonies. One, a church service at Good Shepherd Funeral Home, 24th and J Street in Omaha. An Omaha police escort, they escorted us all the way out to Sack Museum, which is in Ashland, Nebraska, I don't know, 30-some miles. From there, we had a law enforcement escort for the whole distance. And in every city that we stopped at, Lincoln, York, Grand Island, Lexington, you know, Kearney, all the way through, we had a police escort from doorstep to doorstep. So we had a funeral procession for 300 miles by the time you figure we went through these towns, too. So I can't think of anybody else that has had, for someone that just, that was homeless or whatever, nobody wanted, that had a funeral procession for 9-10 hours for 300 miles with a police escort. It's really great going down I-80 at 75-80 miles an hour, you know, and you see 100 motorcycles plus cars, you know, well-wishers. So, and then we had two dinners at the same time, 60 miles apart, because we had a dinner in North Platte for the people that lived in the North Platte area and western Nebraska, and we had a dinner in Lexington for the people that rode in from the east. So we had two dinners at the same time for everyone at no charge. So,
amazing.
You know, the money we do, we put it to good use. We really do. And so that's basically what we do. And, you know, we start all over. And we start to work with funerals. Now, right now, I am in the process. Well, matter of fact, the law in the state of Nebraska states that a funeral home, crematorium, or mortuary with cremated, unclaimed cremated remains after 60 days and a reasonable attempt. Now, your idea of a reasonable attempt might be different than your neighbor's or mine or whatever. Attempt to locate the next of kin if after the 60 days they can dispose of those remains. And I had one funeral home in a small town in Nebraska tell me that when I talked to it, we just go out the back door, and we scatter it in the wind.
And oh, my gosh.
And I said, even a veteran? And they said, yeah, it doesn't state. So I have been working on having this law changed because,
God,
believe it or not, our Congress, 112th Congress of the United States in 2012, voted on a Veterans Recovery Act. And that states that the funeral home, crematorium, or after 90 days, they can actually turn the remains of the veterans over to a veterans 501(c) or C3, I'm sorry, organization for burial at no charge, and there's no liability. Well, I have, and MIAP has had 22 states change their laws to fall into that category. But the problem with that is it is not grandfathered in. So all of these veterans from World War II, Korea, Vietnam, that have been sitting on shelves, the federal law doesn't cover them.
No.
But the state laws, and that's what I like I said, I just received the first draft from a state senator that I've been working with, and that's to get this law changed so that I can go to every funeral home in the 93 counties in Nebraska, and I can knock on their door, and I can show them this law and say, there is no liability. You don't have to worry about being sued or anything like that. Now, if you have a veteran, I will take him. I will, him or her, I will, you know, and I will explain the whole program. And if you want to remain anonymous, you are, you know, anonymous. There is no one that will know that, other than the cemetery itself, will know where these veterans came from. Now, the best thing about this whole thing is, if a veteran is cremated, well, if they're buried in a national cemetery, a VA cemetery, and the family decides they want to move them. Say, you know, I'm buried and I'm from Texas, and for some reason or other, you know, nobody in the family knew where I was or what happened to me or whatever. And they happen to, you know, hear, well, you know, I heard your dad died a couple of years ago. Oh, he did? Oh, yeah. Well, where was, you know. So they start looking, and they find out that Bill Henry was buried out of Fort McPherson in September of 2013.
Mm-hmm.
They can contact the cemetery and ask for the form, I forget what the number is, to get my remains and take them wherever they want. Now, there is no charge for that. All they have to do is get the form notarized and everything and approved by the VA. They take it up to the director of the cemetery, hand it to them. They go over to the columbarium. They unlock it, and they hand them the urn. Now, the family's responsible for the transportation, but they can take me back to Texas and bury me wherever they want. Or they can put me in another veteran cemetery, federal cemetery, down closer to their home, at no charge.
Hmm.
So, you know, it's a win-win situation for everybody if everybody will let us do what we're set up to do. And that's what, you know, nobody knows about us. You know,
what
you got
was
two
that
guys in the
legislation?
State of Nebraska. Pardon me?
I'm sorry. What was that piece of legislation called again? Because this is going on all over the country.
The federal legislation was Act Senate Bill 3202, Veterans Recovery Act, 2012-2013, and it actually went into effect this last June. You know, they always wait. It was approved, and MIAP is in it, and it was approved it was presented to the Senate in December. I think it was approved in January 2013, and it had to go to the VA. The VA director approved it in June, and then they had to wait a year. So that is where, you know, that's why it really didn't go into effect until this last June. And
how could they not grandfather it? That just blows me away.
We were just happy to get this.
Yes.
I mean, you know, it's not perfect, but our national, of which they do not give us any money. We do not give them any money. I mean, we're even though we use their name in their process and stuff like that, we are really self-sufficient. You know, Larry and me, we are our own veterans. And just like in California, Florida, whatever. Here's an idea of, since 2006, MIAP has nationally visited over 1,600 funeral homes. Out of that, a total of 9,800 cremains have been found, of which 2,415 were identified. And out of that, 2,193 were interred, and over 200 were reunited with their next of kin. Now, here in Nebraska, we have buried 8 out of Fort McPherson. We buried 1 that they wanted buried down at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, and we have reunited 10 with their family throughout, and they were throughout the United States. And I either took them and delivered them, or we mailed them registered. You know,
wow, and that's only, you've barely been doing this a year. That is quite
a lot. Yeah, 21 months.
Wow.
And right now, the month of November, in Pennsylvania, Florida, and South Carolina, they had buried a total of 31 veterans and their spouses just for the month of November. And in December, Southern California is going to bury 25 or inter 25 more. So, you know, it's a national, you know, we're in every state, and you can, you know, because like here in Nebraska, all there is Larry and me, and we got some part-time help that when we actually have the service, because it's basically very boring. There's no excitement of sending a letter to a funeral home and then knocking on their door or calling them, trying to get an appointment. And, you know, I have heard, he must have just left through the back door so many times that I even tell the receptionist that. You know, I know it, but we eventually get to them. And we do have some that call us, especially from Western Nebraska. But I'll bet you we've had, ourselves, 20-some that did not qualify. By that I mean that, granted, they were in the military. Maybe they were not in it for 181 consecutive duty days. By that I mean that to receive VA benefits, you have to be in the military consecutive duty days for basically 6 months and 1 day. The reason they did that was because, remember Vietnam? Those people that did not run off to Canada, a lot of them joined the National Guard or the Reserve so they wouldn't have to go to Vietnam. Well, you know, and then they wanted all the benefits. Well, you know, somebody got smart and thought, well, you know, basic training and your AIT only last like 170 days, so we're just going to cut you loose, and then we don't have to worry about you. Because you really, you know, granted you performed a service back then, but back in the, you know, 60s, before, or any time, the 50s, before Vietnam, and even after in the 80s, how many people that were in the National Guard and the reserves really did anything other than their weekends and, you know, 1-2 weeks a, or, you know, a week a month,
right.
A year rather. Mm-hmm. So that's why they did that. And also, you cannot be a convicted felon. I don't care
okay.
if you received, you know, you were one of the most decorated. If you are a convicted felon or child sex offender, I mean, that is in black and white, a child sex offender. You will.
They're
going to
stay on the shelf.
They're going to stay on the shelf. Yes, they are.
Mm-hmm.
And,
or in this case, if they're not grandfathered, they're going to get tossed out back, I guess.
Yeah. Either that or somebody just going to sit, they're just going to sit there. And because some of the, believe it or not, some of the funeral homes, they feel obligated. And, you know, they might have tried once or twice. And hopefully, because in, as you well know, in Nebraska, our whole population is on the eastern side. You know, everybody,
yeah.
you know, the population of Nebraska is in Omaha and Lincoln. And so with this cemetery here, hopefully the majority of the veterans that are here, you know, that die or, you know, are deceased here in Omaha and Lincoln, die is kind of harsh, but it does happen. They will work to bury these people. You know, and I will be available. And it doesn't have to be just MIAP. It can be any veterans organization, the Legion, VFW, DAV, you know, any that is equipped to do it. So it's right now I have 5 veterans and 1 spouse that are sitting in a couple of funeral homes that want to be buried here in Omaha. So as soon as Omaha opens, I will perform the service and give them their last rites and their final ride home. So, you know, and, you know, we found an abandoned car someplace in Sydney, Nebraska, which is way out west, and
yep.
there was a cremated remains in there. He died in Texas. Don't know how he got to Nebraska, but he was in an urn, and his flag and everything was in that vehicle. And so we were called, you know, to try to buy a funeral home and try to locate and everything like that. And we did locate him. He had 5 sons throughout the United States.
Jeez.
And it took me 6 months because they were all his blood from 3 different marriages, so they, every one of them had, you know, authority. You know,
right.
Not just the oldest, you know. So I
yeah.
had to get the approval from all 5 for us to bury him. And finally, after almost 6 months, and I had taken my problem to our state veterans, and they told me that I could tell them that if they wanted to be arrested for a felony, because in the state of Nebraska, it's unlawful to sell remains. And I said, well, they didn't really kind of sell them. He says, well, that's beside the point. They don't know that. And so I sent them all a registered letter and told them that I was going to turn them over to state. And my phone rang off the hook. I'll take him. So, and I've had one that,
wow.
A husband, wife, and it happens a lot. Say the husband passes. This husband passed in 93, and his wife passed in 97. Well, when the husband passes, you know, you make an agreement with the funeral home that you want to be buried together. Okay, so they hold you, and then, well, nobody claimed them. You know, and so I contacted, you know, I talked to the funeral home, and they told me all about it. They gave me the names of the family and everything. I contacted the family, and they answered the letters and set up an appointment to speak with the kids. And the first thing out of the daughter's mouth was, "Oh, we didn't really think about it." And I'm thinking, it's
Jeez
been...
Louise.
Yeah, right. You know, we're in double digit in years, and you just didn't think about it. And then they said, "Well, we'd like to bury him closer." Okay, you know, you do whatever you want. You know, I don't care. Just I want you to do something with him. But, yeah, that's – and I've had where, like I say before, there's been sons and daughters that have just flatly refused. I don't want to have anything to do with them. You can, you know, and, you know, divorce. How many bad divorces do you know of or do you hear of or were you part of? You know, it's a lot of different things. So that's in my AP for you.
Okay, well, that's really an incredible story. I appreciate you sharing with us tonight. I had no idea about so much of this until I heard from some people about the presentation that you made and then did a little reading on this organization. And like I said, I've been having veterans on, and thanks for their service and you know, honoring their service this month. And I was just shocked and appalled to know. Now, are any of these unclaimed bodies people that were, I mean, you think of bureaucracies and the paperwork and the screw-ups and the long chain and all of that, are any of these people, you know, families that thought that their loved one was missing in action and actually made it home? No.
Yeah, they had all, every one of them had, you know, they had served their country for whatever they had, you know, signed up for, re-enlisted, or even retired from the military. And,
sure.
You know, they came home, or, you know, and they tried to start their lives or, you know, go on with their life or whatever, and you don't know what happened, you know, between hand or while they were in the service or anything like that. It's
gotcha.
You know, I talked to, you know, some of the families that I've talked to and everything. Even there's been some that they thought that, you know, their grandfather or their dad or their uncle or whatever, he was in Vietnam or, you know, he was a veteran. And then when we start to do the research, find out that, okay, he was drafted, and we had one that he was drafted, and out of 24 months, he had went AWOL over 180 days total, four different times. So, I mean, you know, and he had received, you know, dishonorable discharge and everything like that. And so they're, and we'll have caregivers, you know, homes call us.
Sure.
And they'll give me the information, and I'll try it. And they didn't serve, you know, the requirement, or, you know, they did something. The VA just, you know, they just deny it. And
right.
And then, you know, I work with the service officers, and, you know, we try everything we can. I had a lady call me. It was last January. Her son had went to one of the meetings of our Returning Veterans Resources Group. And what we do is we try to help these kids that are coming home, teach them how to get through all of the bureaucracy, you know, the paperwork, what, and everything like that, and help them. We even have what we call a moving them forward, where a guy in our, he's a retired Army, Gulf War, and what he does, he collects furniture. You know, people they go out, they go someplace and buy a new couch or whatever, and he collects it, and then he with the VA and Goodwill and, you know, different organizations, they will find a apartment for him. Well, okay, it's great. Wow, we found this guy and his family an apartment. Guess what? They don't have anything. They don't have. So he will take, at no charge again, he will take the furniture and move them into this apartment at no charge and set them up in their household so that, you know, they can go forward so that the veteran can get a job or whatever he needs, but he doesn't have to worry about a place to live and furniture and, you know, silverware and dishes and stuff like that.
Right. So I know they do
lady,
this.
Her son was there, and he asked, I wasn't there for that meeting, and he had asked one of the guys about me, and so they gave him, you know, my phone number and everything. So he gave it to his mom, and she had called me, and they lived down in Kansas, and she had not seen her brother since 1973, and, you know, nice lady and everything, but, you know, she was a big family, and she was the only one left, and she had not seen or heard from him since 73, and she had some ideas. Last time she heard, he got married, and he lived in Las Vegas or Reno, Nevada, somewhere in there and everything, and through the grapevine, she had heard that he had died, but, you know, she didn't know where, and so I got as much information as I could, and I gave it to one of your DAR genealogists, who helps me a lot. She designs a lot of our paperwork for us and everything, and she traced him, and granted, he died in Florida, and he received a military burial, and so she was able to, it was able to give her closure. And we, I called her on Valentine's Day and gave her the good news. And it just happened to work out that way. And so,
aww.
Yeah, we've helped the city of Bellevue. They had 7 Civil War veterans that they didn't have any markers for. And they knew they were buried, but they didn't know where. And we found them. And, you know, found them for them and helped them. And just last month, I helped somebody up down south find information on a Civil War veteran that they wanted to get a headstone on. So, you know, it's not
wow.
just, we'll try to find anybody. Here in Nebraska, I will.
Yeah.
Anybody that lives in any of the 48 states, you can go to you can Google Missing in America Project. And there is a list there that says contact us. There's a list of all of the volunteers in every state and who is the volunteer coordinator. He's in charge of, you know, he or she, they're in charge of the state. And you can contact them and you can volunteer your services. Maybe you know how to trace people. We can always use genealogists somewhere. Or, you know,
right.
maybe you know somebody knows a funeral director. You know, you're good friends with or he's part of your family, a funeral director. You know, we'll use any information we can get, and we'll use any help we can get. Or you can also Google Missing in America Project Nebraska, and you can see what I've done. You can see our videos of our services and our after-action reports and everything like that. We're more than our federal government, we are really transparent. Everybody can see what we do. And there's even a section that shows what is upcoming, you know, who has scheduled these events, or you can go down and you can find every every event that we've had, or every interment that we've had since 2012. You can go all the way down, and you can find out what city, you know, what state, and everything. And there's a lot of the, you know, you can go to Arizona, your state, and most of them will have some information. We're also MIAP is also on the CFC. I forget what number they are. So if you want to donate on the combined federal campaign, the only money that we use is for legal fees, because at times we have to, you know, we have to have legal representation to do something. And
sure.
And that's just one thing we do. Last January, Larry and myself, we were having lunch, and we was across the street from a cemetery, and so we started talking. We said, let's go over and talk to him. So we went over there, and the caretaker was there, and he says, yeah, I have a couple remains here. So he takes us into this room, and he opens this box, and there's two remains there. One of them, a lady, she had passed in 1985. They were still in the box that they were shipped or mailed to them. And a gentleman passed in 1955. And so we did some
wow.
work and everything. And we couldn't prove that he was a veteran. And I was trying to, so I was trying to do it as a public service, but because of our charter, I could not use our name or our funds. And I couldn't find a cemetery that would take care of him for free. So I don't know what happened, you know, to the guy. I'm sorry, I tried. And the lady, she had donated her body to for science, and the Nebraska law states that if you if it was a drop somewhere, somebody dropped the ball, because it's a Nebraska state law, if you give your body to science after they take out all the organs and everything, they are supposed to cremate you and bury you. Well, this didn't happen. So we
wow.
were able to find her attorney through finding a cousin and everything. And I don't know what happened after that. But, you know, well, if I get a name, I had a funeral home that just gave me 47 names. Now, only, I would say, we only 5, maybe 10% are veterans. But we will try to trace every one of them. We are trying to trace every one of them, but we don't, you know. We have the genealogists, and, you know, they have other things to do, too. So we just try to find out as much as we can, and we go from there. And
well,
hopefully we'll have our next service in next May or June, and that will be out of Fort McPherson. And, well, you know, it'll be in the papers. We was carried Memorial Day on WWT. Brian Mastery's had a wonderful on us, and all of the newspapers and TV stations all the way across Nebraska covered us. And people ask me, why do I go to such great lengths to, you know, what's the show for? And it really isn't a show. Yeah, kinda, because there's two of us. We are unknown. So how do you get people to know you and respect you and know what you're doing is by advertising. I can't afford to put ads in the paper or TV slots or anything like that. So when we have our ceremonies, we have to use it to the best possible way. And also, this gives these veterans a service that they deserved many years ago.
Right.
So that's why I go to such, well, MIAP goes to such great lengths. The one in May, if anybody's been to a military funeral, you know how they unfold and refold the flag. Well, for those five, we did all five of them in unison. And that is quite
uh-huh.
a sight when you see, you know, the military unfolding and refolding the flags together.
Yes.
Army, Navy, Marines. So,
hmm.
But that's what we do. And you know, my email address is B as in boy, D as in dog, H as in house, BDH57@cox.net. And anybody can email me, and I'll send them information. Or if they want to make a donation, I'll send them information where to send it. And, you know, I appreciate what you do, and I appreciate you giving me the time to get our message out, just like I, you know, I'm
yes.
reaching people for the whole country. And that is,
I hope
that's
that
great.
Helps. I hope that helps with donations, but also to raise awareness, because that
yeah.
just still blows me away that this is even possible. And so God bless you for helping the way that you have. I'd like to, and for the audience, like you said, you can Google certainly the name
right.
of the organization
right.
in your state, but if you want to go to national, it's www.miap.us. And if
right.
you have trouble finding something in your state, I'm sure you can get a hold of national, and they'd be able to point you to the contact person in your state. I'm just curious, you said 48 states.
Right.
Need to be listening and find their people that are going to step up to the plate and start a branch.
Hawaii?
Do you know?
You know, and Hawaii is, you know, they have a national cemetery, and I'm sure they probably don't have too many that are unclaimed. I really don't know. I know it's Hawaii for sure. And Alaska, you know.
Sure.
Yeah, I really don't know, but I was told that when we signed up and went online and everything, that we was the last of the lower 48, and that's all I can go by, what they tell me and the information that they sent me.
Sure. I have another dumb question for you, and that's I mean, a cemetery is land. I mean, it's not like it's building a sports complex. What's going to take until 2016 to get this cemetery outside
well,
Omaha? Because you're
right. Well, it's 235 acres, I believe. And it's a bean field right now. Well, it was. And by the time, see, you know, all of the cemeteries, they're putting in sprinkler systems. They have to be, you know, go with the EPA, you know, all the environmental stuff and all of the rules and regulations. And, you know, they're on a gravel road now, so they have to, you know, widen. You know, there's a lot of work to put in a cemetery. And this will, in 2000, when they do open, it will only be the first of five phases. It's four or five different phases that, and then as they fill up, they will start, you know, but they have to do all of the groundwork and all of the other work for the whole 235 acres. So, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, permits, you know, there's just a million things, you know, for
that
construction.
That bureaucratic stuff we were talking about?
Pardon me?
I said that bureaucratic stuff we were talking about? That
oh,
just
yeah,
sounds
but,
like a
know,
long
that,
time
that has,
to me.
I am going to try my damnedest that on the day that they dedicate that, when we'll have a governor and our senators and congressmen and, you know, all of the everybody there, I am going to try to get approval to bury on that day from the scheduling office. So that as soon as all the kissy huggins and handshakings and speeches and all this and that, I want to be lined up with 100 motorcycles and four or five hearses. That, and I even had met a gentleman that has volunteered to let us use his hearse from Iowa. He has volunteered where before we carried the remains in the back of a SUV. So, you know, we're getting there. We are getting there.
Yeah,
so,
you certainly are.
But I would love to be able to, you know, attack that cemetery on that day with all those dignitaries there and show them what MIAP is. But, you know, if I can't do it that day, I'll be there the next day because I'm going to be the first one there.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'd love to be
there. I don't care.
I would love to be there with you on that day. Yeah.
So, and we have a Facebook, but it isn't kept up because we don't have the time. And believe me, I am computer illiterate, like I told you. And so we can't keep that up too much. And but we post on Facebook when we do have a mission coming up, and we give the itinerary of where we stop, what time we'll be there, what time we leave, and the whole thing. And somebody, you know, you don't have to be a biker. We have lots of cars, lots of families, lots of grandmas, grandpas, retired World War II vets or whatever, that come along, and they'll ride the whole way. And, you know, and then they turn around and, you know, they stop and get something to eat and they drive back home. So we post that so that everyone will know, you know, when we're doing it, and they will know, you know, what all the times are, and everyone's invited. It's open to the public, you know. So,
sure. Bill, do you know you don't use it often, but do you happen to know your Facebook page, what it's called?
It's supposed to be Missing in America Project Nebraska.
So you spell the whole thing out, Missing in America.
Yeah, you spell the
Project.
Whole thing out.
Okay,
and
that's maybe why I didn't find it.
And it's, believe me, it's very, we had one where a guy was keeping it out for us, and we made the mistake of after we have every service, we make a video of, you know, a slideshow with music and everything. Well, we made the mistake of using some songs that we did not give permission to use. As a lot of people have. I know you.
We've had
you
experience here. Yep.
Yeah. And so we were forced to take it off. And so the guy that did it for us, he just took it all off. And he says, I ain't doing it no more, which, you know, I mean, he spent hours. You can imagine, like the May 30th one. Well, in September, we have a guy that we call our national photographer. If he has the time, he can get off work, he will come there. Well, he came to our September one. So he took 300 and some photographs, and then other people take photographs, and everybody sends them to us. And then we try to categorize, you know, put them all together as sequence. And that's a lot of work, you know.
It is.
The May 30th, we had 785 photographs from 15 different people. And, you know, this guy, he put all this together, and then he, you know, put music with it. And it, you know, it's a lot of work. And he does, you know, there again, he did it for volunteer, and then he posted it, and, you know, all of a sudden the music police, you know, contacted him, so he took it all off, and he said, you know, I can't do this no more. Yeah.
I do want to ask you something, if you remember it, and then I want to go back and tell you a surprise. And then there is a question or two on the board that have been patiently waiting, and I know it's getting late for you.
Yeah.
But I wanted to ask you, just because we have a couple hosts that I've told them that will happen to, and as long as I have you on air, and you and I didn't know each other before now, so we didn't discuss this. But, okay, so you were an organization that didn't have the appropriate license to be playing royalty music or music under label. You did, and what happened. They do in fact contact you then and threaten you with royalty fees and all kinds of terrible stuff.
Lawsuits.
Yep.
If we had 30 days to take it off. If we didn't take it off, we would receive a royalty fee bill. And if we ignored that, they would see us in court.
And for our hosts who thought that nobody would do that to an organization like Brain Injury Radio, they will do it to an organization who are getting unclaimed remains of veterans and burying them at their own cost. So if they're going to do it to their organization, you know, they don't really give a rat's patootie what your organization is. If you're playing unauthorized music, you will be addressed when they catch you, and they will, as our founder knows, not because he got in trouble, but because he knows and a couple hosts just choose to ignore it. There's a lot of music that has code embedded into it. It's like a secret espionage thing that they've got going out there in corporate America. They actually embed a code that, I don't know, sends off a big bell somewhere in a high-rise building where all the royalty police are, and so they can track that. Don't do it. But there are a lot of indie artists, and then when I see you out in a little bit, I'm going to play one of them from Albany. And what I did to find my way around that in the back half of my show is I found out that there's an awful lot of artists out there who own the rights to their music who are not on label, so they still own the rights to their music. They didn't sell their soul to the devil, and they are very willing to be helpful to organizations because, well, A, you know, like we're talking about, it gives them exposure, but it also doesn't hurt business to be a friend of Brain Injury Radio or, you know, the Missing in America project. And so that is an idea. I talked to my husband a little bit. I might have mentioned to you that he's 20-year retired Air Force, and we'd like to talk to you about getting a web page up. He works, so it's not something that will be a high maintenance thing, but at least it will give you a presence so that you'll have a page, and we'll pay the fee to keep that.
I'll pay the fee. I'm not worried about that. Larry and me, we've already discussed. My daughter, she's pretty smart on computers, and she wasn't working at the time, and she was going to set one up for us. But then she went back to work, and she just doesn't have the time, so we kind of shelved it. You know what I mean? Because between the time of our ceremony and then going up until January, it's basically just sending. We don't do anything other than, you know, I'm working on the laws, but we just contact a funeral home or an organization to have that I make a presentation, because Larry is employed and he works so much overtime that he doesn't have much time himself. So, you know, I tell everybody that I have the greatest retirement job in the world. I get ignored. I get doors slammed in my face, and I'm lucky enough to spend 40 to 60 hours and pay my own salary. So,
how
can you beat that? Isn't America wonderful?
It is wonderful, and that's why, you know, my husband being a veteran, I'll talk to you off air about it, but we'd like to see about, just so you'll have a presence, you know, on the internet, because you really have to. That's like your calling card these days, you know. To have it, and then
we miss a lot
handing.
Because of that. We don't, you know. I can hand out business cards to everybody in the country, and
they want to know your website.
They want to know the website and everything. And when I tell them, well, I don't really have a website. Well, our national uses Facebook a lot, but, you know, they, a lot of these places, these larger states, they have, you know, somebody that is retired or has a lot of knowledge on computers, and, you know, they'll put all that stuff in there. But, well, Larry and me, you know, we don't have the knowledge, and we don't really have the time because there's only two of us. So, you know, so we try to do what we can.
I can help you with the Facebook page, and my husband, Gary, will help with the web page.
You're hired.
Page.
The pay isn't very good.
Yeah, we work for free too. So,
okay.
What the heck? At least I'm used to working for free. He works for the government, and like I said, I'd probably be feeding all those pictures you're talking about through the Facebook page because that's more work. But he can get the web page up and running, so you have the presence. And it talks about what you do, and it puts Nebraska on the internet highway to let you have a web page, and we'll take care of that for you. Although I do want to know, now, does Larry also ride a bike?
Yes, he does.
And does he go to Rolling Thunder too?
No, he's never been on Rolling Thunder. He's, you know, like I said, he works a lot. Boy, does he work a lot. And, you know, he rides when he can. You know, we'll do fundraisers like poker runs, you know, that the motorcycle clubs have. And, you know, most of these motorcycle clubs are veterans. They really are. And, you know, if you look at the money that these clubs have, you know, every weekend there is a poker run somewhere in the state. Every weekend there could be
very
a
active.
Lot of there's two or three there, and they raise a lot of money for you know causes. You know, it's not only you know for you know breast cancer or stuff like that. It could be for a family. You know, a child or whatever. Somebody was in an accident and a friend of theirs decides, well, let's put together a poker run. I have, in January, one of the Navy's honor guard that she's a girl. I guess she is a girl. She is a girl, but I'm getting tired. But anyway, she lives out in western Nebraska, and she wants to have a fundraiser. And I told her, I says, you know, she asked us, and I says, yeah, fine, whatever you want to do, you know. Are you going to, what are you going to do? She says, I'm going to have a beard growing contest. Okay, you're going to have a beard growing contest. She says, yeah, I think beards are neat. So I said, well, you know, I don't care, but, you know, and people come up with different ideas, and you know, I've had some clubs they'll have a poker run, and they have donated 50% of what they you know make after all the you know to us, and I get a lot of not only monetary, but I get physical donations, like a corporation here in Omaha. They do all of our printing of our programs for the funerals, you know.
Right.
And you're talking solid color, two-sided, and 300 to 400 of them. Now, if I take that to Kinko, well, how much would that be?
No, that's a wonderful donation for sure.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to let our caller on to ask you a question, but you talk to Larry someday. The only favor I need back, and it's a funny favor, and especially among United States Marines, but I want a Marine that goes to Rolling Thunder because I need to have him have a little visit with another Marine. And I think you know who the guy is going to be. Well, actually, I can just say, you know Tim Chambers From Rolling Thunder, the waving Marine?
No, not right off the top of my head, I don't.
Well,
by the time
waved.
They get here, there's over 800 of them.
Right.
By the time they come through Omaha, I do not, you know,
well,
I might know
there
him by his face.
At Washington.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, by the time at the final destination, he's out
right.
there. But he's got a reputation as the waving Marine. He waves until each one of the bikes, and it's a long time, as you know how
oh,
many.
Oh, you mean
bikes.
The Marine that salutes?
Yes, the saluting Marine. I'm
oh,
sorry.
Oh,
yes.
Yeah. I don't know him personally, but I know who he is. That he stands there with a hand salute for the whole as
for
everyone
the whole
passes.
Thing.
Yeah. Yeah,
yes.
I know who that is. And, I know who it is, but, you know, I don't know him personally.
Yes. Well, he's a Marine, and I'd like another
right.
Marine to have a visit with him. A year ago, 9/11, I did a special 9/11 tribute show, and I wanted someone who had survived the Pentagon and someone who had survived New York. And he committed to me in writing and verbally that he would be on the show that night, and he stood us up and he didn't even apologize or contact me afterward.
Oh.
And my dad was once a Marine, always a Marine. And
hey,
as you were talking
oh yeah.
about,
I hope you don't say you're a former Marine because, oh man.
Oh no, if I was the Marine, I would already found him, but next Marine from Nebraska going to Rolling Thunder, I'd like them to have a little visit with Tim about some of those fundamentals of Marine Corps 101, you know, honor and maybe calling to apologize or not leaving us hang, not leaving me hang,
well,
you know, that night after
you,
promising.
You type it up and I'll get somebody to hand it to him.
Okay, great. For that, you get a
yep.
website and a girl to do your Facebook.
Yeah. Yeah, you type up what you want to tell him, you know, and all the information, and put it in an envelope, and I guarantee you it will be handed to him. I can't guarantee if he's read it or answer it, but it will be given to him.
God bless you.
Because my brother-in-law is a Marine, and he lives in Manassas.
Oh.
So, yeah.
All right.
And so I will give it to him, and he will be there because he's there every year.
Great. Well, the next 9/11, I'd like to see Tim show up.
And so you find out where he's at, and we'll get it to him.
I'll do it. Okay, I'm going to unmute our caller, but if anyone else wants to call in, the number is 424-243-9540. Again, 424-243-9540. You can call toll-free in the U.S., 855-473-3711, or outside the U.S., 202-559-7907. And with that, I'm going to bring on Les Paul from South Carolina, who is also a host. Les, meet Bill.
Well, Bill, I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you from the bottom depths of my heart, because I know people who went to Vietnam were not appreciated and not treated right. And my brother was in the Vietnam era, and he knew a lot about how they were treated, spit on, looked at like they didn't exist. And I just thank you so much for all you've done. I don't know
well,
how to say thank you enough.
You know, I appreciate it. I really do. And, you know, the only thing I can say, like I said on the show, it's therapy for me.
Yeah.
It is mental therapy for me. It really is. Especially after I have, you know, after I do, you know, I work my butt off, especially the month before the ceremony.
Yeah.
You know, and lining everybody up, talking to, you know, 9 different sheriff's departments, 7 different city police departments, city councils, mayors, county commissioners, and everything, and then lining everything up. You know, we work our butt off. And after it's all done, it's so fulfilling, you know. It's like the greatest Christmas I ever had, and then all of a sudden, you know, you open all the presents, and then you go, and that's why we kind of take a little break, you know, during the summer, because I like to get on my bike and ride across the country, and we just take a break and recharge our batteries, but, you know, we keep trying, and it's just the right thing to do.
It is. I just wanted to say that I live near Augusta, Georgia. I live in Aiken, South Carolina, but I live right across from Augusta, Georgia. We have a large military base there at Fort Gordon, and a lot of troops went off to Vietnam right from there. And I have met so many of them over the years. I've worked with people that were in Vietnam, and they all told me so many bad stories about the treatment they got when they were leaving and coming home, and these guys were just going to serve their country.
Yeah,
and it's sad how it was done, but I'm proud to know you and get to speak to you. I'm not going to take too much of your time. I know you're probably getting tired by now, but I just want you to, I want you to know that this old boy in South Carolina, I'm playing the way I'm saying it, thinks you're awesome and appreciate you for coming on tonight.
You know, I appreciate that. The one different thing that I had when I went to Vietnam, it was popular.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. It changed. Yeah.
What, you know, I graduated from high school in '62, and so when I went to Vietnam, it was, you know, it was kind of the you know, no problems, and you know, oh, you're going to Vietnam? Oh, yeah. Okay, you're going in the Army? Okay, you know, no really big fanfare, but it was, there was nothing, you know, derogatory from anyone. But even when I came home from basic and schooling and jump school and stuff like that, after all that stuff, it was still it was still the right thing to do. You know, we're going to help, you know, defeat communism, and we'd rather do it over there than on our doorstep, and all this, you know, other stuff that everybody that was for it said, and then
what you're doing for the remains of the warriors who passed is beautiful. I just love that, how you're doing that, and it needs to be on a big scale nationwide, and they do need to see you in Rolling Thunder. I can't wait to see how you're going to do that. Kim and I are friends. We do these shows together sometimes, I'm just so honored to hear you tonight. So thank you.
Well, you know, I thank, you know, everybody for listening. It's a passion, as I'm sure you can tell. You know, I really believe in this wholeheartedly, and
it's easy to tell.
And I keep telling everyone that, because when I first started, it was estimated that there were 100,000 veterans in the United States that were sitting in storage rooms, you know, cremated remains. And Omaha had 500. And, you know, like I keep telling everybody, I think I'm down to like 482 left to do. And I wish that it would make me so happy that when I do the next one this spring or early summer, that it would be my last one. I would love that, but...
Well, one question I had was, I almost forgot it, was, do you work with any other veterans organizations to try to get them involved with it, too? Like we have in Augusta, Georgia, the Wounded Warrior Care Project, and it's a pretty big project. And I know several people that deal with people, and they go to the funerals when they pass away and things. I just wondered if you guys could work together. One guy's name is Daniel Smith.
Yeah, we... you know, like the Patriot Guard, because I ride Patriot Guard. I go to as many funerals as I can, and homecomings, and, you know, deployments and everything. And the AMVETs have really helped us a lot. So has the VFW. But our biggest veterans groups that really do the most for us are the biker clubs, the combat vets, the Veterans for Christ, Bikers for Christ, and, you know, stuff like that. They are the ones that really do the most for us.
Well, when you said Poker Run,
Yeah, for the poker runs and everything, because, you know, you can raise at a poker run if it's for a good cause and it's on the right weekend and you have it set up. You know, some of these poker runs, they'll raise $4,000 or $5,000.
Yeah, that's awesome.
You know, and so, and you know, if they give me a part of it, you know, of course I you know, we'll set up a table where they start and they finish, and you know, people donate, and then we'll be involved in a 50-50, you know, and maybe sell some, you know, patches or T-shirts or something like that. So we make some there, and but it's the veterans poker runs that really do a lot for us, and
yeah.
We try to do as many as we can to help everyone too.
That's great.
My wife's a weekend during the writing season. She's a weekend widow, believe me, because I'm always gone. But she understands, and she is a mentor for the school system here by our house, and the kids that she mentors are service children. You know, their parents
okay.
are stationed, are in the military, and you know, they just need somebody to talk to, and she is a good listener. As you can tell, she'd have to be to put up with me, because I don't shut up. So, but I thank you for, you know, everything.
Thank you.
And you know, I hope you'll keep MIAP you know, in your mind and in your thoughts and your prayers. And you know, if you decide that you want to donate something to them, like I said, they have on the national website, it's Contact Us, and you can contact any MIAP volunteer coordinator, even South Carolina and anywhere. Their phone number or their email address is right there, and you can contact
okay.
them and tell them you want to donate, you know, for an address or something. Because of today's world, I can't be giving out my address over the air. I think you
I understand.
All can appreciate that.
Yeah.
But that's unfortunate. That's the way it has to be. But again, I thank you very much for your time.
You too.
Thanks, Les. I'll bring you back. And for anybody in Nebraska who might be listening, who is interested in making a donation, if you didn't catch Bill's email earlier, you can reach him through me. If you go to my website, inaflash.org, there's a contact, and it sends an email directly to my desk, and I'll see that you're hooked up with Bill. So that's at inaflash.org. And I'll make sure that Bill gets the message. Bill, I want to thank you so much for your time and your service then and your continued service now. And I really appreciate you being on the show tonight.
Well, you know, I thank you very much, because, like I said before, it's all about getting our name out. And I can't think of a better way to get my name out than on a nationwide radio show. And, you know, for the whole Missing in America project, we're a small organization, but we do big things. And so, you know, I want to thank you very much, and also for donating to do our website. I will be calling at your door.
Yes, and we'll be happy to do it. I talked to my husband after the first time I talked to you, and so I'll be talking to you off air in the next few days, and we'll see what we can do about that. And I'm going to let you go, tell you goodnight, but I'm going to send you off with a song from one of my indies. And so he's from Albany. His name is Chris Dukes. And this song is goes out to you and all of our veterans. This is called Heroes. Good night, Bill.
Okay, thank you very much.
You bet. And the rest of you, I'll be back in 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Standing up against the cold, my heroes.